Hello. My name is Rabbi Josh Yoder, and I'd first like to thank you for taking the time to download the very first of what I hope to be many podcasts off of either iTunes, one of the other places where I know this podcast is streaming, or off of my website, Utopia, currently located at www.joshyoder.com. For those who don't want to read my bio on the website, I'm currently the rabbi of a synagogue on the Lower East Side. That I'm a second generation rabbi. My father, Rabbi Alan J. Yoder, is currently rabbi of B'nai Israel in downtown Baltimore, who's been at this for a lot longer than I have. I've learned a great, great deal from him. That's I'll talk about it maybe some other time. You know what? Might even get him on here. That could really be a lot of fun. I've also been a longtime J blogger of what I've just checked now and found that it's been almost 7 years since I started blogging. That does make me feel pretty old. In fact, when I recently moved over my blog from movable type to WordPress, I was just thinking back about, you know, what things were like when I started over at Blogspot, when you didn't even have comment support and you had to bring it in from JavaScript. And then I realized that you really must be old when you start waxing nostalgic about the old school days of blogging. Maybe it's just sad, but anyway. So since I've been doing the blog for a while, now I'm actually, you know, starting off into podcasting. I'd like to first take this time to explain, you know, why and what to expect here. So the first reason is simply because now I can. Since I moved to WordPress and, you know, for many advantages that I already wrote about on the website, there's just a lot more that I can do, or at least there's a lot more that I can do that's a lot easier to do than I could have done with movable type. I'm sure there might be some techies out there who are going to say, oh, you just need to do X, Y, or Z. But the truth is, WordPress has just been fantastic because plugins take care of just about everything, and they are so simple to install, and upgrades are just such a pleasure. And in case you're wondering why I would even start with a podcast with a blog, there are really a couple of reasons. The first is that I don't really have as much time to write as I once did. For those who've read the blog, you realize that I really do need an editor, and it takes a long time for me to get everything out in exactly the way that I want it to do. There's some, you know, really good pieces up there that I've been very proud of, but it's hard to keep writing at that type of quality, that I'd really like to keep up. Theory had always been, you know, better to, you know, write less but write better, because there's enough stupidity floating around the web. I didn't really need to contribute to it. Another reason is that I started blogging just to practice writing, and writing for publication in a way, but writing in a way that other people would read and would comment. And I think it has actually helped me communicate ideas in print. So the theory is, if I start podcasting, eventually it'll force myself to get better in terms of speaking, holding down conversations, and things like that. So I pre-apologize if that's going to be a little bit rough for a while. Next, I mean, I'd like to learn more tech. Right now I have a very simple setup with just, you know, microphone, headset, and running Audacity, which is free, and, you know, learning how to do more stuff, which is always good. Hopefully I'll be able to, you know, use this to collaborate with some of my brilliant and talented friends of mine from a whole bunch of fields. Have a couple of them lined up who have expressed interest once we have things a little bit more taken care of. And in the end, maybe I'll be able to reach a broader audience and get the ideas out to more people who otherwise would only have stumbled upon Utopia because they were searching something, or maybe they found a link someplace. In terms of content of what you can find up here, I may put up some recorded shiurim or classes or lectures that I might give. Not necessarily from my own shul, though, because when I do give classes that are shul-related, most times, or at least when it's done on weekdays, I try to have it more conversational. and really solicit a lot of feedback from the people who are there, which one doesn't really translate well if you're just sitting listening and can't be part of the conversation. But I also don't like it when, you know, I would rather have people feel more comfortable say whatever it is that they'd like to say rather than worry about saying the wrong thing and having it, you know, posted online for, you know, generations and maybe archived for, you know, permanency. Maybe I'll put up here the occasional drusha, the occasional sermon that I do on Shabbat. When I first started here, I used to be very careful about having everything just written out really carefully, and I realized I don't really have the time, which has helped me improve my ad-libbing skills. I don't think too many people would disagree with that. You know, the ad-libbing has improved a bit, and, well, I mean, it helps that I also don't go on for that long, but occasionally there's some good stuff that I come up with even on the fly that, again, I just don't have time to, I don't really have time to write down. As far as updates, it's probably going to be whenever I feel like it. To be blunt, hopefully I can get, I don't know, I'm not even sure if I'm going to try for a schedule, because, you know, you'll see that I personally really enjoyed a lot more when I get to have conversations with very cool people, so that's all going to be dependent on everyone else's schedule, and I know everyone's crazy busy and all that. And the only disclaimer that I'd like to put here is, all opinions are going to be subject to change, you know, so try not to hold me accountable too much for anything, and, you know, if you'd like to quote me on anything here, I would just ask that, you know, you get in touch with me beforehand, you know, to see if I've reversed my position, and I do anticipate opinions changing. One of the many things I learned from my father that he loves to say is, if you're never willing to change your mind, you don't have a mind to change, and I think that's true, and I think, you know, it's one of the risks that people take when putting stuff online, that you never know what someone is going to do with it. Maybe you could, you know, hopefully your thoughts would evolve over time, and certain things you might revisit and, you know, disagree with, other things you might agree with more strongly. So please keep that as just one disclaimer as we go on. The first topic of conversation for today, and I'm going to fly solo because everyone else was busy and couldn't schedule. So I'm going to do this by myself, and the first topic is going to be the upcoming RCA, Rabbinical Council of America's, proposed amendments. The Rabbinical Council of America has been discussing two amendments to their constitution, which has gotten quite a few people upset. Today I got one email directly from Jofa, and another one that was forwarded to me, the exact same email, because people just want to make sure that I know what's going on. That reads as follows. The Rabbinical Council of America, the RCA, is having its annual convention. Gives the dates in Scarsdale, New York. The issue of women in religious leadership roles is featured prominently on the agenda, with multiple sessions devoted to the topic, including one calling for the establishment of an official RCA position. As a major rabbinic arm in the Orthodox world, the RCA is in a position to demonstrate its support of women in leadership roles. As an official RCA policy on women's leadership roles has the potential to enable motivated and learned women to assume leadership positions in our school synagogue and other religious institutions, thereby strengthening the Jewish community. You, bold underlined, can make a difference. Speak with your rabbi. Let him know that you strongly desire to see your efforts and support from the RCA to enable him to enable women to assume positions of religious communal leadership. Two, encourage him to attend the convention and urge the RCA to focus on finding new ways for this motivated group of learned women to contribute their skills, passion, expertise to the Jewish community. And three, ask him to encourage the RCA to help find places for female leaders in our religious institutions, enabling them to transmit their knowledge and expertise to others. That's the email that was sent out. I should point out here, personally, professionally also, I am currently a member of both the Rabbinical Council of America, the RCA, and don't even know how to describe it in relationship, but another international rabbinic group called the IRF, the International Rabbinic Fellowship, that we'll talk about in a little bit. Now, here, when you have, you know, Jofa making this statement here, which, you know, makes perfect sense considering that Jofa stands for the Jewish Orthodox Feminist Alliance, are certainly going to want to have a feminist, you know, type of, I don't want to say agenda, but definitely certainly a feminist type of message being promoted towards the RC, promoted in the RCA. Personally, I'm not going to be going to the conference. I can't really afford to, either time or money wise. So I will not necessarily be voting, but I think it's, you know, very interesting to see exactly how they responded, in particular because the two amendments, are not specifically, dealing with the issue of women. You know, for those who have not been following, there's been the whole big issue of ordaining women rabbis. I'm not going to repeat here. I'm actually in the process of working on a separate post about specifically the ordination of women in Orthodox Judaism. But today I want to focus exactly on the two amendments that are currently being discussed, because neither one really addresses the issue of women, or at least not in the way they do, or at least not in the way that's implied. And of the two amendments, one of them is probably not as, not as expansive as people think it is, and the other one is probably a lot more expansive than I think anyone realizes. So I'll discuss both of them now. The First Amendment reads, "No person shall be eligible to be elected or appointed as an officer of the RCA or to the Executive Committee, Nominations Committee, or Resolutions Committee of the RCA if that person is a member of any other national rabbinic organization whose principles or tenets of faith are antithetical or contrary to the policies or positions of the RCA, as determined by the Executive Committee of the RCA. This section shall become effective 30 days after enactment, and memberships held by persons in other organizations prior to that time shall not be regarded in applying this rule." So the first thing to realize here is that this amendment is only discussing holding certain positions, or at least of policy-making positions in the RCA. Does not call for a ban from the RCA, only certain prohibitions for higher-level officer positions. Now, this really shouldn't be surprising. I know people might have objections to this, but, you know, truth be told, you know, the RCA is an organization, and as an organization, it has every right, if not an obligation, to really set forth what it stands for and what it believes in. And if someone is, you know, disagrees with it, they're free to try to convince the membership from the ground up. But if someone, you know, is, you know, clearly has, you know, contrary positions, or positions contrary to the established party line, to the point where they will take the step of active membership in another such organization, you would not want to have them wielding, let's say, disproportionate membership power over establishing what the policies are. To be sure, if someone's part of this organization, let's say, hypothetically, the International Rabbinic Fellowship, which, though not mentioned by name, is probably the subtext here, there's nothing preventing an IRF member from being part of the RCA, from talking to RCA members, or having influence through, you know, the purpose of, you know, through the function of argument and discussion, and perhaps being able to convince people on the merits. But I can certainly see that if, you know, from the big organizational perspective, they view the IRF as a threat, you would not want to have a member of the IRF in a position where you can affect what could be considered significant damage to the organization. So here, I don't think this statement alone is that much of a big deal. I think it will force the RCA to really establish what it is that it believes in. And this is where it starts getting a little bit more interesting, that the determination of which groups are antithetical or contrary to the policies of the RCA are, quote, determined by the Executive Committee of the RCA. And which means it's going to be inherently subjective based on this a priori body that, you know, may or may not be affiliated with the IRF. I do know people in the RCA who may be sympathetic to the IRF, but for one reason or another don't want to join. But the question is, how are they going to make those decisions, and what's going to cut it? For example, would Satmar Chabad make it? And I mention Satmar because, you know, they're very well known for not being Zionistic, or rather anti-Zionistic, to varying degrees. Would someone who's affiliated SOTMR, I don't know how many SOTMR members are actually part of the RCA, but would you also say that someone who's part of SOTMR could not serve on these committees? What about Chabad? In relatively recent years, the RCA put on their application form a checkbox that you had to sign affirming that the belief that the Messiah died and needs to be resurrected in order to fulfill his mission has no place in Judaism. That's a requirement now to say that you don't believe in that statement, which was, again, most likely done as an anti-Chabad polemic. So would you consider members of Chabad, or at least the Messianic side, well, assuming that they'd be grandfathered in the RCA, part of, would you consider that to be ineligible to serve on these committees? What happens if you have another organization that sets up that's not the IRF, that says, we're a rabbinic organization that's dedicated, hypothetically, to, say, following Rambam, or committed to following Gemara Rambam and Shulchan Aruch, defined by, let's say, Rav Yosef Karo, not even the Ramah? Would that also be considered antithetical or contrary to the policies or positions of the RCA? Probably would, because the RCA does not follow any single halachic position with any degree of consistency, because, let's face it, no one does. They'll certainly quote from a canonical body of texts and opinions, but by no means are they going to be 100% consistent in terms of constructing their policies. So that will be interesting to see exactly how that's applied, whether or not it's specifically for the IRF or any other things, but the truth is, I don't envision that question coming up all that much. And again, this is a relatively minor position to take, because it's only a determinant for the officers, and it's not in any way an exclusion for members holding membership in two bodies at all. So that definitely ought to be said. I guess if people were really upset by it, they can quit one organization, get themselves on the executive committee, and then say, we're going to now decide that the IRF, hypothetically, is no longer an issue, and then everyone can go back and forth. But, I see this more as an internal matter within the RCA. The second matter is, I think, a lot more interesting. And it says here that any member of this, I'm now reading from the text of proposed amendment number 2. There's actually a third amendment I should mention here, but it has to do with more of the procedure of ratifying these amendments. But here's number 2. It says, any member of the RCA who attempts to ordain as a member of the rabbinate or to denominate as rabbinical or clergy a person not eligible to serve as such, as those terms are understood under the policies and positions of the RCA, is deemed to have voluntarily withdrawn from membership in the Rabbinical Council of America. The section shall become effective 30 days after its enactment, and such ordinations or smicha conferrals extended, but subsequently rescinded prior to that time, shall not be regarded in applying this rule. So, you'd be silly not to think of this as a reaction against the Maharat Rabbah controversy that has been going on for the past year. Now, to point out a couple of things here, this decision is less about the individual musmach, the person who's receiving smicha, but on the one who is doing the ordaining. 2, the ramifications are clearly greater. Here, we're talking about expulsion from the Rabbinical Council of America if someone gives smicha to a person who is ineligible as understood by the RCA. Now, this statement is really, really vague, and you can start thinking about just how expansive this is, in that what it effectively does is it's giving the RCA, in a sense, a much greater control, or wants to wield a greater control or influence over really all sorts of ordinations. Now, again, we're not talking about how, in practice, it's going to be enacted, because the truth is it can go either way. But as written, let's think about some of the different scenarios that might come up that could fall under this category. Typically speaking, when people discuss smicha or ordination, we talk about something called yora. For the most part, it's these are tests that involve the section of Shulchan Aruch called Yoredeya, primarily the issues of Kashrut. But there are a whole lot of private smichot floating around that don't necessarily follow that exact pattern. For example, Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg, who's probably one of the more popular private smichot, and he has his own set of restrictions for who can sit down and take the test, which is really an open book test on Shulchan Aruch, on the Shulchan Aruch, but he gives smicha on other topics that I know of, like, let's say, Shabbat. Would that be enough for it for someone to necessarily be called rabbi? I know Chabad has their own criteria for their rabbinic ordination program. So when the RCA here says that a person not eligible to serve as such, does this mean that they're now going to start questioning people's smichot from, say, other institutions if they don't like their curriculum? Meaning, if they don't study the exact halachot that they expect a rabbi to study, let's say they want you to study, Yoredeya, right? So even here, what's considered part of Yoredeya? In the YU curriculum, we learned Hilchot Shechita, which I've been told is not included in the Rabbanut. So, if you want to say, well, we're going to hold by YU's definition, well, if you hold strictly by YU's definition, you'd exclude the Rabbanut, which is kind of ludicrous. In terms of the tests of on Yoredeya, they're also drastically different. In Yeshiva University, we focused more on Shach and Taz. In the Rabbanut exams, from what I've been told, they focus more on Beit Yosef. Will the RCA get this far? I don't know, but it's theoretically possible that they could, and it could be that they're moving towards some form of a national standard, or not a national standard, but certainly an organizational standard of what they consider to be legitimate smicha. In theory, they could exclude pretty much anyone affiliated with YCT, such that if they disagree with the curriculum or disagree with the personal the personal character of YCT students, that in theory, they could use this as an excuse to kick out of the RCA anyone who is currently involved in ordaining YCT students. I'm sorry, I should explain. YCT being Yeshivat Chovevei Torah, the rabbinical school started by Rabbi Avi Weiss several years ago. I guess in this case more of as a competition or as an alternative to Yeshiva University. And they've, put out quite a few rabbis, certainly no worse than the worst of YU, which, I can say freely having gone to YU myself. But this is a little bit more, if I'm reading the amendments here, this has very little to do with women in any leadership position, even if that was the motivation. But truth be told, the text as written extends far beyond just ordaining women, but rather is really the RCA, theoretically, determining what's considered any sort of a rabbi. And the definitions for how this would be determined are fairly vague. It says, as those terms are understood by the policies and positions of the RCA, which is, of course, subject to change and is, of course, to various interpretations and no doubt its own issues of politics. So that's the read of it so far. And it's the second one is something that I would be a little bit more concerned about. But there is one other factor to consider here, and that is, again, the RCA is its own organization, and it can set up whatever rules and regulations it wants to for membership. The bigger issue is, what does it matter? In that the body might be called the Rabbinical Council of America, but it wields no innate halachic or political pull over the Jewish communities at large. I could very well see that if the RCA does try to expand its authority too much, it will receive a backlash from it could get a backlash from Jewish communities who don't want to be a part of it, don't want to be affiliated with it, and think that, they've just gone too far, in which case they would de facto lose influence. In other words, I can see this decision, or at least this amendment, if passed, theoretically, could lead towards a real greater schism, which they can say is, your fault for going away from us. But it really assumes that they are the center and they are the ones that have the right to define what is considered a rabbi or clergy, to the exception of everyone else. Certainly, right now, it's a fairly large body. It's an influential body. But given that it does not have the same Das Torah cachet, if you will, the same sort of religious authority or religious social authority that, say, Aguda might have over elements or other elements in the Haredi world, I'm not sure if trying to pull a power play at this point in Orthodox Judaism is really going to serve to their advantage. But that's, you know, neither here nor there, and that's more strategic. Personally, if I were voting on the, I don't know, I have to check out to see if I can send in a proxy. I'd be okay with one, the First Amendment, surprisingly, because, you know, let's face it, if someone is, you know, going to be part of another organization that's actively trying to, you know, subvert important parts of the RCA, I can see the logic in not giving them positions of power, or at least, you know, restricting them from positions of, you know, decision-making positions, unless, of course, they wish to change the RCA policies through their own internal means. I honestly don't know exactly what they are. I haven't read the full set of bylaws. Actually, no, that's not true. I skimmed through it once, but I'd have to double-check and, you know, maybe read through it a little bit more carefully to see exactly how it works. I don't really have too much expertise in constitutional law of any form. But the second one I would reject out of hand, particularly as it is written. It is far too vague, and because it is far too vague, is really open for a great deal of abuse. And I would really be nervous about such abuse, not only because you know, you'd be really forcing a schism, but the truth be told is I do like the RCA, and, you know, from I'm a member of the RCA because I think it, you know, does do a great deal of good, or at least it could do a great deal of good, and I do believe that it does have influence, and I'd rather not have a schism in Orthodox Judaism. I'd rather not. It's, you know, I think I realize why the politics and the personalities are getting involved the way they are, but my own personal vested interest and why I'm actually a member of both organizations is, you know, realistically speaking, as influential as the RCA is, I'm not sure it's as influential as it thinks it is, in that I do know there are quite a few Jews and Jewish communities who could really, really care less what the RCA has to say on any policy. And maybe an organization like the International Rabbinic Fellowship can have more influence in that regard. And for various reasons, you know, people are not going to take the IRF seriously for, you know, whatever reasons they have. So personally, I would much rather have two very strong national or international rabbinic organizations that can wield appropriate influence in terms of spreading a cohesive value, certainly cohesive values of Torah, and have that degree of influence than to have, you know, two groups of rabbinic organizations that foster a greater split in our already fractured Jewish community. I hope it doesn't come to it. I do hope that cooler heads prevail. I don't know enough of the personalities behind it yet to know if they will, but I do hope that things do in fact settle down, and I hope that people on both sides realize that the mature solution really is to acknowledge that, you know, you've got, you know, different sides within Orthodoxy that can certainly reach different people in the community, and ultimately do better work that way. Again, let me just conclude here with a repetition of one of the more important things that I wrote on the site, is that all of this discusses the term Orthodoxy, which, as I see it, is more of a social designation. The most important designation that I believe any Jew ought to have is that of Shomer Torah, which is one who keeps the Torah. I use this more than just Shomer Mitzvot, which is definitely a component of it, which is do what the Torah tells you to do, don't do what it tells you not to do. And by Torah, we have a Torah Shebichtav, the written Torah, which, you know, we call the Bible, and the Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral Torah, which was codified in, you know, the Gemara, that we have its recordings of what was part of it. You know, for greater detail about how the oral law system works, or for everyone to read Maimonides' Introduction to the Mishneh Torah. And, you know, beyond Shomer Mitzvot, being a Shomer Torah also includes being Shomer Machshava, in terms of not being monodogmatic, of being able to realize that just as in the Torah you've got multiple arguments or multiple perceptions on certain halachot, you also have multiple perceptions on machshava, on Jewish thought. And instead of presenting Judaism as a monodogmatic religion of this is what Jews believe and this is what all Jews have to believe, in particularly in this way, that you in fact do have a range, even within what we would consider the canonical Torot of Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaal Peh. To me, that is a lot more important than whether or not someone calls themselves Orthodox, post-Orthodox, heterodox, whatever nomenclature classification people decide to use. If we're really going to be serious about Judaism, and if we really believe that, you know, the main point of Judaism is doing what God tells us to do, I think it pays to go back and look at, well, what does God tell us to do and what does God want us to do? Start from there, work our way back, and, you know, start making evaluations of what don't really fit into that message anymore. Thank you very much for listening, and please subscribe, and I guess the new episodes will come down as soon as we're done. Thank you very much, and have a great day.